Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Davood Gharami, a cosmopolite by nature. Davood is a filmmaker and visual artist with an MFA in documentary media from Ryerson University in Toronto, Canada. His experience with the cinematic medium spans over two decades and is taken to the four corners of the planet. His area of interest is the condition of human, as well as the wide and interdisciplinary studies territories the subject covers, including social justice, internationalism, the environment, and the culture industry. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Much appreciated. Thank you for having me, Derek. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me about, or tell all of us about your extraordinary new film, Age of Iron.
Definitely. So Age of Iron is a documentary that I started producing almost 7 years ago. It has been a project of love, basically, that me and my sister have put together completely without access to resources, 100% independent production. No corporate sponsorship, obviously, because of our politics, no governmental funding and grants, and nothing, basically, from any source other than our sweat of brow. So it is a project that looks at the concept of global capitalism and the side effects it creates, both in the political north. Those side effects generally show themselves as alienation, and in the political south, as obviously poverty and abuse of labor. I have traveled in some cases with my sister Yasi, and sometimes without her, to 10 countries in Asia, making this film. And how it started was actually accurately as the film shows, based on a dialogue I had with my ex-girlfriend back then about the situation of human beings in various countries in Asia. Of course, there is a country such as Japan in Asia, a very affluent society, first world, as much as I hate to use this term, but it is the condition of the severity of exploitation is not as visible as the rest of Asia. And then it was mind-blowing to me living there in Japan that a lot of the Japanese are completely oblivious to this fact, that beyond their borders, something completely different is going on. Sometimes when they want to travel, they travel to other affluent countries, such as Europe or the United States or Canada. So this dialogue has started between me and back then my girlfriend. And when my work was done in Japan, actually, before wrapping up my work in Japan, I started looking at the work of an artisanal knife maker in the vicinity of where I was living in Nagasaki area, meticulously documenting this art that this family possesses, and they've been doing this for more than 100 years, basically. I was recording what they're doing, look at their artisanal lifestyle, and I was asking this question: if we want to disconnect from the rubric that capitalism imposes and lead a non-exploitative life as a couple or as a family, is such a thing possible, or is it too utopian? And the film basically explores that. And the answer I found, obviously, is that it is impossible, because the resources come from the corners of the planet, and everything's so intertwined that simply by, you know, living as a modern human being these days, we are exploiting other human beings as well as nature and resources. So, some parts of the film happens in Japan and the other parts in 9 other countries in Asia that I visited with the intention of investigating labor and resource related issues over the course of a 1.5 year of traveling. And Age of Iron is the result of that.
So I see a couple directions we can go. Either A, why Age of Iron? And or 2, would you like to start with the effects of some of the tangible effects of this alienation on industrialized nations, and then sort of follow your own journey into the other countries? Which direction would you like to go? Age of Iron or follow the journey from Japan to the colonies?
Let's talk with the Age of Iron, since the answer to that one is pretty short. So Age of Iron, for an obvious reason, the backbone of the film, the skeleton, the structure of the film revolves around, as I mentioned, the art of this artisanal family that make knives in Japan. And everything is about iron. You know, they get it as resource and they work on it. It's a meticulous, beautiful process. And they make these knives that they have lifetime guarantees. And they sell it to mostly chefs in Japan, or families that work in the food industry. The naming of it came from it accidentally in the period I was thinking about this. I was reading The Metamorphosis by Ovid. And around the beginning of Metamorphosis, which is one of my favorite books of classical Latin literature, Ovid delves into mythologically explaining how humanity got to where it is right now. And he mentions various ages, the Age of Iron, the Age of Gold, which came before the Age of Iron, where everything was perfect and innocent. And then basically he gets to the Age of Iron, which, as he describes it, became the age of profit, became the age of exploitation, became the age that men started to claw the surface of the earth, started mining and started exploiting nature as well as other human beings. I was completely petrified by this description, and I thought, you know, this is something written more than a millennia ago, but it's still poetically valid. And I used it as the title of the film, and also the quote starts the film, actually.
I think that's really great. And another absolutely brilliant thing about the film and the and everything about it is that, you know, you chose this artisanal knife maker, and at the same time, you know, we're definitely still not only poetically but also physically in the Age of Iron, where I don't remember the numbers right now, but you know, iron, steel is, the civilization would collapse almost immediately without steel. And it's not too much to say that it is the foundation on which so much of the entire culture is made. It's one of the brilliant things I think about your whole discussion.
Exactly. Yes, we are. We are undoubtedly in the Age of Iron. I mean, just think about all the wars we have fought since the introduction of modernism. I mean, think about the First World War, the Trench War. Think about the Second, and, you know, even nowadays, yes, it's the nuclear age, but we're still killing each other using iron. Think about governments that have collapsed in the 20th century. If I'm not mistaken, a good example would be the government of Salvador Allende in Chile, because of those resources, or a government like Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran, through that CIA and they call it the Ajax operation, the removal of Mossadegh because of oil. All of these links to industry and what it's doing. Think about, just to name one person, think about Ford, Henry Ford, and, you know, the consequences of Fordism, both in the United States and Canada, as well as, you know, the countries that are exploited for those resources. We are still in that age of iron.
So can you take us from Japan to the other countries and talk about the effects of capitalism or the age of iron on how the effects are different in different places?
It'd be my pleasure. So the journey starts from Japan. We kind of go to Myanmar. That's the first stop in the film, after portraying what this family business is and showing a bit of the process of the work. We go to Myanmar, which I visited at that time. Aung San Suu Kyi was still in power and they were having another democratic election. But right off the bat, going there, I realized the vast exploitation of resources that's going on in Myanmar. In Myanmar, you know, it's famous for its very dense teak forests back then. Like, you read the works of, for example, Orwell, who actually lived in Myanmar as a police commissioner in Quetta before leaving for Europe, and you read about these forests and what's how wild and how thick and how beautiful they are. But today you travel in Myanmar and everywhere you see teak lumber floating down the rivers. You see the stubbles of forests left. There is no more teak. I mean, everything is exploited. To the north of it, jade is being exploited. There are jade mines. Most of them are being exported to China from the north. To the south, you have oil. You have forests being completely clear cut for palm oil or rubber plantations. I was there to mainly investigate the situation of rubber plantations, which ended up in the film, as well as I was aware that Myanmar is kind of a frontier. There is China there with her own interests, as well as, you know, the American NATO camp. The so-called Association of Eastern Asian Countries. Japan is a member of them. And there are rival projects going on in Myanmar, rival projects of, you know, building deep sea ports, of building pipelines, various pipelines, roads, train. Everyone has basically gone there to get a piece of that pie, which is on the table. And in the meantime, the human expense of it was also of interest to me, specifically the condition of the Muslim minority, which, you know, after the shooting of the film, as you and some of your listeners might know, there was this huge exodus of Muslims leaving Myanmar and in a number of cases, massacres of Muslims, and they were fleeing to the neighboring Bangladesh. So we linger in Myanmar for a bit in the film, and then we visit again. After all of these little segments, we go back to Japan to see more of what is happening in there, in the shop of the knife maker family. We later visit Bangladesh. Again, another exemplary victim of what is going on today in the world in case of labor. What was very interesting for me were the so-called shipbreaking yards in south of Bangladesh, in the mouth of the Ganges Delta, where mostly the ship that are going to be abandoned are driven to these mud plains, and then with like really simple methods, these ships are broken into pieces, and the everything that comes out of them enters the Bangladeshi market and gets recycled. So there are towns there where you can basically see everything that comes out of a ship, and side by side, prostitution, poverty that coexists with this is visible. So that, and it relates for me to again, the iron as one of the material that is essential, as you mentioned, in the modern world. So we're there visiting what's going on in Bangladesh. Of course, the other reason for me to be there was Bangladesh's history that connects to colonialism. I mean, the whole story, the inception of the country of Bangladesh, how it came into being, the partition of India, its relation to the dark history of British colonialism, the East Indian Company, and, you know, centuries of exploitation. So we sometimes tend to forget that we live in that post-colonial era, and we don't realize that actually colonialism is something that has never stopped, and it is still ongoing, and there is that huge divide between us and them. We might not see it. It is not presented to us, unfortunately, through our mainstream media, because our leaders and so-called journalists do not favor our exposure to such concepts.
So wait, that I'm not disagreeing with you at all, but I have a hard time. I mean, anybody who has followed back a chain of supply knows that those supplies have to come somewhere, and they were ripped from the ground somewhere, and that place was somebody's home. And I mean, I guess I see it all the time too. I'm agreeing with you, but at the same time, it just seems crazy to think that it's actually post-colonial. I mean, it's they still are the suppliers of the raw materials. And I know you're not saying that we're actually living one. It just boggles my mind that anybody could be so, have such blinders on that they don't understand that the computer that we're talking over required materials from, you know, I don't know, 27 different countries, and the taking of those materials required force, etc. Sorry to go off on this, but it's something that has always kind of boggled my mind, is that people can't see those connections.
You know, I would actually divide people into more than just one camp, two at least. There is, of course, that group that are oblivious to the fact. They don't follow the chain. They don't find the answers as you or I have. And there is this large majority who actually is aware of the supply chain, but they choose to stay oblivious. They choose to forget the reality. We have, you know, created various sediments in dealing with these maladies, just feeling ourselves, helping ourselves feel good. You know, one is the one that actually in the film, there is a segment that I rebuttal this. There is this, you know, Hobbesian attitude of calling it human nature. You know, well, we exploit. Yes, we do. We colonize. Yes, we do. But, you know, if we don't do it, the other people on the other side of the border will. So what's the difference? So we have these very complex mechanisms of justifying whatever wrong we are doing. And one of the goals of the film was also to, you know, have a poetic kind of an argument with people from various camps and kind of tickle them to a little bit of discomfort, so that they change the way they perceive.
So that brings us to another sort of split where we can go. Do you want to talk about some of those, or do you want to continue talking about the countries that you went to?
Oh, no, I can leave some of the, I can name the countries, and I can leave it to your audience to explore the film on their own. Without the spoiler. So there is, as I said, Myanmar, there is Bangladesh, there is Mongolia, which we were in Mongolia mainly for the mining that's going on in the Gobi Desert. There is China. There is mainly most of the segment in China happens in Western China, in the region occupied by the Uyghurs. We also visit India. We visit Cambodia. We visit also Afghanistan, which for me was one of the highlights of the film. And yeah, I hope I'm not missing. Oh, yes, I am. Tajikistan and Uzbekistan also, because they were very important regarding water, which is another resource that currently people are fighting over.
Before we move on, can you introduce people a little bit to Tajikistan and Uzbekistan? Because I think a lot of people in the West, you know, we may know India, we may know Bangladesh a little bit, but we may not know much about those two countries. Can you do a very quick overview and how they fit into the problems?
Of course. So Tajikistan and Uzbekistan are basically new countries that came into being after the fall of the Soviet Union. They were territories that in the war between the Tsar Empire and the Persian Empire, I think 250 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, were lost to the Russians. Then they became members of the Soviet group. And then after the fall, they gained independence, which is a very interesting story, because you have a cluster of countries in Central Asia. They've never been really countries, and their borders were drawn hastily, kind of, during the Soviet times, but there were no internal borders between the Soviet countries. But then after the fall, they want to become countries with all these new leaders. So resources again become very important, and there are civil wars, mainly for the flow of the Oxus River, which is this very important river that starts in the Pamir Mountains, from the glaciers of the Pamir Mountains, and flows all the way to the Aral Sea, which used to be the fourth largest lake in the world, but now it's a desert and a tiny lake attached to it, because mainly of the mass exploitation of the waters of the Oxus, for cotton plantation in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan. So that was the reason for us to visit those two countries.
So you've done a fabulous job in this interview so far of talking about the sort of social and cultural and ecological effects in the places you've been to. But the story in the film is also personal. And can you talk about some of the personal costs associated with the Age of Iron? Not you making it, but for the people in the film.
Yes. So the personal, this is the way I saw the film, again, based on my own experience with my ex-girlfriend, was I wanted the film to be a form of a love letter to a lover that, you know, for the reason of difference of ideology, we had to kind of stop, I guess, our relationship. And I incorporated that into the fabric of the movie. And from the get-go, I wanted this film to be a complete form of a POV, of me looking at the world, of me talking about the world I am experiencing and this other person cannot experience because physically she is not present with me. So it is a very personal portraiture from that perspective, almost to the level of, you know, performativity. The other people involved, as I mentioned, are the family members. There is Tanaka-san, who is the knife maker, his mother, who also helps in the workshop, as well as his wife. And they're an incredible family. I spent beautiful, beautiful, meaningful time with this family. They were very hospitable, opened their doors to me and showed me what they have been doing. And we had a beautiful collaboration during this film with them.
So I want to come back to I want to go back to Myanmar for a second, because it feels significant to me that, you know, this will air in a few weeks, but we are doing this interview December 6th, and there have been some activities in Myanmar over the past week, I think, that apply to this, over the past 2 weeks. I'm talking about the coup. I guess the question here is can you talk a little about the relationship between iron and this exploitation and militarism / community self-sufficiency on the other hand? Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Of course. Yes, it's that Myanmar is a very complex society. Again, one of those dire side effects of colonialism. Again, we're talking about a territory that wasn't really a country. The British came, they took over, they exploited. Afterwards, the Japanese came. Brutal colonialism by the Japanese was experienced there. And out of there, they have movements for independence that reach fruition. They finally form a country, but it's a very tribal society, at least the way I explained it, I explored it. So there are clashes between various tribes, and there is that lack of democracy, obviously, which puts the military junta at the higher echelon of power. They have, like any other military dictatorship, access to resources, guns, and they have foreign accomplices. That's one major force in the Myanmarese politics. And on the other side, you have, you know, the so-called Democratic Front and the ongoing fight for democracy, which Aung San Suu Kyi, the deposed leader, I think it was a couple of days ago, finally, the verdict came that she was sentenced to 4 years of imprisonment. So that was the Democratic Front led by her. She's a Nobel laureate, and I'm sure your listeners are familiar a little bit with her personality. But what was very intriguing to me was the fact that it really doesn't matter who's on top. Exploitation goes on because it's a country rich in resources, and there is always foreign buyers. Now, it depends which side you want to go. Do you want to deal with the Chinese government, which is, you know, one of your neighbors, and, you know, they don't have that colonialistic approach to foreign territories, at least yet. They come for business, they come for resources, they pay, they build infrastructure, and they go. Do you prefer that, or do you want to, you know, be aligned with the, as I mentioned, Americans and their allies in the region and work with them? Regardless of which way, there is always exploitation of people, unfortunately. Some people are always at the bottom of the food chain, and they're easily sacrificed and are stepped on. And that's only the human aspect of this exploitation. The other aspect, which in your work it's very evident and you focus a lot on, is the situation of environment and resources, which again, Myanmar is one of the apotheoses of what's going on the larger scale around the world. As I mentioned, the deforestation, which is mind-boggling. Water, what's going on with about the fights with their neighbors over water, palm oil plantations, rubber plantations, as far as I can see, everywhere, exotic animals, you name it. And for some reason, they all, you know, their resources end up where we live, on the other side of the Atlantic or the Pacific, right?
No matter who's in charge, the orangutans or the elephants lose.
Exactly.
So we have about 10 to 12 to 14 minutes left, so it's not quite time to wind down, but can you start to aim us toward what? One of the things you say in your promotional material is that you ask if, you know, is there a way out? And I mean, in some ways that answer, and I don't mean for you to spoil the end of the film, but I mean, I guess the question is, the first question is, what do you want us to do? I mean, what do you want to do? So I'll tell a quick story. I was going into Canada one time many years ago, and I got stopped at the border, and the guy's really questioning me about my politics. And, you know, at first he was really annoyed with me for any number of reasons. And then we were just chatting for a while, and by the end of the conversation, he's like, look, I understand, and he let me in the country. But anyway, he said, so I understand that, you know, the corporations pretty much control everything. I understand that the world's being killed by the corporations, and I understand that the media is run by the corporations, and we, you know, but so what do we do now? And of course that, I don't really have an answer to that. And the point is, I think that there are a lot of people who fundamentally understand that you can't have iron without a mine, and then what do you do with that information?
Excellent question. Excellent point, Derek. The fundamental question for me, basically. One thing is clear to me. This has to stop, and this cannot go on. We are seeing the consequences of the way we've been running this business. You know, when you go back to old, you know, works of the old philosophers, even when if they were emancipatory thinkers like Marx, for example, as a good example, you see that there are factors that he didn't take into consideration because it wasn't that evident during his time. And environment is one of them. You can pollute as much as you want in Manchester. You can, you know, make fabric and sell it, you know, to the rest of the world, exploit, get the resources, make it, destroy your own environment. But it's okay. The wind is going to come and take whatever comes out of your smokestacks somewhere else, and life goes on. We are a different generation. In the 21st century, we are firsthand experience of the end of such a way of thinking. Everything we do comes with consequences, and we are that generation that are now completely aware of those dire consequences. You know, extinction is just around the corner. I guess the first stage, which is the stage that I think we are in, is to raise awareness, and it differs from people to people. For me, as an artist, a filmmaker, I always say my machine gun is my camera, what I'm fighting, and I hope I can, you know, have resources and the strength to continue doing what I'm doing. It is extremely hard, but that's the weapon I have chosen. Is it going to be enough? Obviously, no. Awareness raising is one, but regardless of that, a point has to come where we as citizens, we need to form collective consciousness. We need to get together and think about alternatives and impose our demands on the holders of power, or the wielders of the blade, as I call them in the film. I doubt that, you know, our leaders are ever going to listen to us or wake up. I mean, look at what was going on in Scotland in the latest climate summit. Look at what went on, you know, under Donald Trump. Or is it still going on under Joe Biden in the U.S. or anywhere else for that matter? It is up to us. It is up to us to start asking questions, start talking to each other, and start organizing to the point that we are strong enough that we can be influential. And there are conspicuous examples of this way of thinking. It was 2 days ago, I was listening to an interview by one of my favorite artists and musicians, Brian Eno, and he said something that resonated a lot. He's like, have you guys noticed that the environment is that issue in today's world that has united all of the people? Everyone's kind of thinking about the issue of environment. So we've done a lot of work, but it's not going to end here, because you know, if you can reason with power, things should have been sorted out by now. Unfortunately, you can't, and action is necessary.
So We still have a few minutes. Can you, and I have two questions, I think. One of them is, can you tell people how to see your film?
Of course. So the film most probably is going to be premiered online on December 15th, 2021. We are finalizing a negotiation with a European distributor. They're going to release it on their online TV and later on their platform. But the best way to find us is through the website of the film, which is ageofironfilm.com, or through various social media that my sister and producer currently is setting up. I think Instagram is a good way. Just search for us, search for the IMDb page of the film, and through our website, you can go to pages where you can view the film online.
Oh, and just to be clear, so that people can search for you, can you spell your name, please?
Yes, D-A-V-O-U-D, that's Davood, and G-E-R-A-M-I, Gerami is my last name.
So, and so what, I really love this film, and what I want to, I know this took you a long time to do, but I want to see more films by you. So please tell me you're working on, you're starting to think about something, another one.
Much appreciated, Derek. Yes. I mean, if I have enough resources, I like to make a minimum of 2 films per year. Unfortunately, you know, we're always bogged down because of finances. We have to, I always say it as a joke. I've spent a lot of my life waiting, unfortunately. But yes, we are working on, it's been a very long time that I wanted to do a fiction, go back to the world of fiction. And there is a post-apocalyptic film, a fiction that I have put together. I wanted to shoot it initially in Japan. It didn't work out, but currently I'm based in Spain, and there might be windows of opportunity to get this done with the, you know, guerrilla style, no permits and shoestring budgets that we work with. So that would be the second one, the new one, pardon me, that we want to focus on, hopefully. If we can put the resources together.
And will that one, let's presume that you got some resources for it. You said 2 films a year. So if things went the right direction, we could see this in what, a year and a half, maybe?
I hope. Yeah. As soon as the finances are ready. Filming of things, especially when it's fiction, it doesn't take a long time. Documentary is way more arduous to do because of, you know, all the traveling that it entails normally. But fiction goes pretty fast in shooting once the resources are there.
So one last question, which is there anything you've wanted to say about the film that I have not asked you the proper question to do? Is there any other message you want to leave listeners with?
It's an invitation of viewership. I want to mention that, as I said, we work completely independently because we don't want any strings attached. Now, we can only continue to do what we're doing if we can build up a strong viewership. So far, under this company that we have together with my sister, we have 2 productions. One is this one, and the other is Sustenance, a movie about the politics of food that we have produced. That is gaining a lot of momentum out there, and this one requires viewership. So I love it if your viewers can, you know, on a grassroots level, talk about us, talk about the film, come engage, leave comments in the review page of IMDb for us, organize public screenings if you want. We love to participate in public screenings, and we have all of the rights because we don't work with exclusive distributors. We can organize town hall screenings. So if your viewers are in the mood, if they have a small community somewhere, they want to show the film, I personally would be delighted to participate. We are all on board. Through Skype or Zoom or whatever, we can also show up for a Q&A with your viewers, with your community. And I always say, I don't make films for the red carpet type of a crowd. I like the grassroots. I like the people of, you know, the normal people out there, the people of genuine communities to be my viewers and supporters.
Well, thank you for that. And also you mentioned Sustenance, and I just want to give a shout out to that too. That's another excellent film. You and your sister are both fabulous filmmakers.
Much appreciated, Derek. And thanks. Well, that one wouldn't have been possible without your participation in it as well.
I was fortunate enough to be interviewed, but I was a tiny part. So in any case, thank you so much for making this film, and thank you for all your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Davood Gharami. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.